Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Parenthood is trying to keep your head above water. Parenthood is swimming through a deluge of contradictory advice. Expose your baby to peanuts early. Nope, nope, nope. Wait at least a year. Or how about let your baby cry it out? Nope, nope. That could cause irreparable psychological damage. You can hear the back and forth in your own mind, I'm sure. Now, for some questions, there are conclusive data that settle the matter. But for others, you just have to decide for yourself. And that can feel paralyzing, especially when the stakes seem so high. I mean, it is, after all, your kids. So our guest today, Emily Oster, well, she's an economist, and as such, she has waded through the available data on various parenting conundrums, just right for our data-obsessed modern lives. This hour on Point, for more relaxed parenting, maybe think like an economist. And you can join us. Do you thirst and hunger for some data analysis about the best parenting techniques out there? Or do you think data cannot help us find the way to great parenting? What is your question for Emily Oster? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And Emily Oster joins us today from Providence, Rhode Island. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, and her new book is Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. Her earlier book was Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong, and What You Really Need to Know. That one was from 2013. Emily Oster, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, since I just referenced your earlier book, Expecting Better, which many, many people read, what's the biggest difference between looking at data regarding pregnancy and the data that you looked at regarding parenting?
So I think one big difference is in the case of pregnancy, there were many more cases where the data was pretty conclusive. Like, we looked at the data and was like, okay, this is the thing you should do or the thing you shouldn't do, or the data really gives you the answer. And I think in parenting, there are a few things like that, but there are many, many things where the answer is the data helps you think about the choice, but ultimately family preferences are super important in actually making the choice. And so one of the things people have said about this book is, you know, I thought you were going to tell me what to do. Yeah. And the answer is like, no, I can tell you how to think about it, but you have to make those choices.
Right. I mean, in pregnancy, we're dealing with lots of biological factors, which maybe data can help illuminate more. But parenting, again, it's this art versus science of parenting and how family factors matter so much. So give us a little window into your early parenting experiences. Were there situations in which you thought, oh, I wish I had better data for what to do right now?
Yes, many. So I think part of what was for me was like so overwhelming about early parenting was I felt like every moment there was another important decision that I might mess up. And, you know, it was hard to see the forest for the trees a little bit. So I sometimes tell a story about getting really obsessed with the question of whether my daughter should wear mittens or not, yeah, because the doctor told us she should. And my mother told us that if we did that, she would never learn to use her hands, which, like, of course, like, sounds crazy. But, you know, when you're tired and you have a 5-day-old baby, you're like, oh, maybe that's a concern. Like, I definitely wouldn't want to risk that. And so I think that I had this kind of like overwhelming sense of how can I make any of these decisions? And of course, data is actually not there to help you with the mitten question.
Right.
But it was there for some other things.
I'm laughing because I'm feeling a sense of deep recognition right now.
Yes.
Especially when child number one came along for us. All of a sudden, I just, you know, first of all, you're exhausted, you're overwhelmed, and you have to keep this now person in your life alive. And you're flooded with advice from people who you love and respect, right? And then also lots of millions of strangers on the internet as well. I mean, is that part of the problem right now, that we don't really have sort of a set group of parenting authorities that we can turn to? We have anyone and everyone willing to give advice in the internet age.
Yeah, I think that the internet in some ways can be great, like the internet community, because, of course, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You want to know if that is an okay color for your kid's poop. Like, the internet is there for you on that. There are people who are awake and they're gonna be like, yeah, that happened to me. Don't worry about it. But at the same time, there is more people to give you advice, and advice can be great, but it can also feel a little bit like judgment, and it can end up being a little bossy, and you can get hugely divergent pieces of information where it's hard to, where kind of both sides seem like whatever choice you make, you're doing something wrong. And I think that's part of the anxiety that comes up around these choices.
Right. And so a little later, we're going to talk about how we can distinguish actual data from opinions that are masquerading as data. But Emily, I'm wondering if you could, I'd love to give folks a little flavor of the book here. Could you read a little bit from the beginning of Crib Sheet about all the big decisions and questions that parents have to face?
Sure. There are many big decisions. Should you breastfeed? Should you sleep train? And with what method? What about allergies? Some people say avoid peanuts. Others say give them to your children as soon as possible, which is right. Should you vaccinate? And if so, when? And there are smaller ones. Is swaddling actually a good idea? Does your baby need a schedule right away? These questions don't die out as your child ages either. Sleeping and eating just start to stabilize, and then you'll get your first tantrum. What on earth do you do with that? Should you discipline your kid? How? Exorcism? Sometimes it seems like it. You may just need a break for a minute. Is it okay to let your kid watch TV? Maybe one time the internet told you watching TV will turn your kid into a serial killer. It's difficult to remember the details, but maybe don't risk it. But boy, a break would be nice.
That's Emily Oster, professor of economics at Brown University and author of the new book, Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool. So, Professor Oster, let's take a close look at one major source of stress and concern in new parents' lives, and that's the issue of sleep, which you mentioned in that little excerpt here. I first want to actually play a couple of things that we just found from very quick searches on the internet, which I would raise my hand. I'm absolutely as guilty as the next mom of that 3 a.m. desperate smartphone search for advice on what to do. But here, for example, is vlogger Catherine Vogtberg explaining how she sleep trained her babies at 8 weeks. This is from her YouTube channel, Now That I'm a Mother.
The reason why you want to get your baby on a schedule is because then you can anticipate what they need and they start developing natural sleeping patterns, which is super cool. They start finding, oh, okay, I'll nap at 10. Oh, I'll nap in the afternoon. They start to kind of figure that out by themselves those first few weeks. And it also is really helpful because they're used to being held off to nurse. They don't get a nurse whenever they demand it.
That's Catherine Vogtberg, a vlogger. Here's another one. This is Ellie Lindquist. She advised viewers on her YouTube channel to always tend to a crying infant, even in the middle of the night.
People say babies need to feed every 2 to 3 hours, and so how can you possibly sleep train if you're breastfeeding? And isn't that cruel? I am an attachment parenter hybrid, and so I absolutely feed on demand. Anytime that Cohen wants to be fed, he gets fed. Before the 5-month mark, you cannot spoil a baby. You can't love them enough, you can't kiss them enough, you can't feed them enough. Whatever they're asking for, they need.
That's Elle Lindquist, another parent vlogger. So, Emily Oster, in your analysis of whatever data exists about sleeping, could you come to a conclusion?
So there's many questions people have about sleep. On the question of sleep training, I sort of try to address what I think are the central things that people ask there. One is, you know, does it work? Like, would your baby actually sleep better after you do cry it out? And the other is, you know, is there any evidence that they are going to be unhappy and poorly attached and have long-term consequences? I think the answers are respectively, first, yes, on average, babies sleep better after this. And I think it's important to say that parents also sleep better. And so actually, you know, having a baby that is predictable, that sleeps for longer stretches at night, seems to positively affect rates of maternal depression, improve some things about marital satisfaction. So there are some benefits there, some real benefits to that kind of thing. On the flip side, there isn't any evidence that that these kind of sleep training regimes have negative consequences for infants, either in the short run or in the longer run, say around the ages of 5 or 6, when you follow up and you see the kids look just the same. Now, of course, I will say that doesn't mean you should sleep train your kid. For some people, this just feels like I would never do this. This does not work for me. And I think that gets back to part of this question about parental preferences. You know, you can look at this data and say, yeah, I understand that this could work for some people and wouldn't be bad for kids, but it's just not for me. And I think that we should respect that choice in either direction.
So in that case, one might ask, how do I put this? what is the purpose of your book then? Because people are desperately seeking answers, right? We're living in an age where, I mean, like, it seems like everything is data-driven, and we just presume that if we find the right data set, it will lead us to the right answers.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the purpose of the book is I don't think you can make that choice correctly without the data. So you actually do need to know that there aren't negative consequences, because that helps you, if you want to do this, that helps you know that it is okay to do. And I think in a lot of the cases, the data is really helpful. It's just not everything. It's not like, I think we do sometimes have the expectation, like, if I have the right data, that will tell me the answer. But I think that's flawed as a premise, because most of the time your preferences have to be an important part of any decision. You can't make the right decision without saying something about your preferences. And so this book is both kind of a guide to how to use your preferences productively and a guide to the data, which is a really important input, just not the only input.
So it sounds like you're sort of a ultra-modern Dr. Spock, right? Trust yourself and your preferences. That would be alluding to Dr. Spock. But also, here's some data to help you understand why you have those preferences.
Yeah, I think that's that. I will take ultra-modern Dr. Spock and his book sales any day.
Well, we are talking this hour with Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, and she's brought an economist's lens to the art, practice, the science of parenting in her new book, Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool. And we want to know what your question is for Emily Oster. Are you looking for data to help you make decisions on how to help your child sleep, about toilet training, about breastfeeding, about behavior, about discipline, every possible challenge that you face as a parent every day? Do you think data can help you find your way? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Emily Oster. She is professor of economics at Brown University and author of the new book, Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Delta, Pennsylvania. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for having Meghna. She's absolutely wonderful.
Richard, yeah, thanks. Go ahead. What's your question for Professor Oster?
My question is why we have three children, grown children, and my question is why people are not paying attention to proud parenting, communicating with children. I see many children, young children today, looking at iPads and tablets and not communicating with parents. And we come from a working class society, grown up, and we have three children who have graduated from a veterinary college, Harvard, and engineering college, and we spent time with them. We coached them. Why are people doing things differently today, or it appears that they're doing things differently today?
Uh-huh. Well, Richard, thank you for your call. Okay, so Emily Oster, I hear two things in what Richard just said. First, about communication and language, with especially, I'd say, young infants there. That's something that you took a look at for the book. What'd you find?
Yeah, so in the book, I look a little bit at first just some facts about language development, because I think a lot of parents have questions about, you know, how is my kid's language compared to other kids, and we have some good data on that. We can also look at some things that kind of, what are the kinds of things that improve kids' language? And, you know, I think not hugely surprising, probably the things we have the best evidence on are things like talking to your kids, reading to your kids, which has longer term benefits also. So there definitely, you know, is something to this idea that those kind of interactions, you know, that's how kids learn language. That's how they learn things about reading and so on.
So isn't that language development or the talking to your kids question one of the good examples about how seeking out data to help figure out the best parenting techniques is pretty hard because there are a lot of confounding factors, right? Because I think most of the language studies I've seen about the efficacy of talking more to your children, what the strongest correlation was that higher income parents tend to talk more to their kids. So is it so much the talking that's really affecting the brain development of the child, or is it everything that comes along with higher income?
No, exactly. I mean, I think this is a problem in almost all of the topics covered in the book, is that the choices that parents make are wrapped up in all kinds of other features of the parents, which we also know matter for kids' outcomes. And as you say, many of these studies, particularly around like counting the number of words, are really also wrapped up in, you know, the differences across families in like how many words they talk to their kids are also all, you know, reflecting all kinds of other differences. We do have some, you know, slightly better data about that over time, and around things like reading, we, you know, increasingly have some both like small randomized trials or papers that have tried to use better empirical techniques to measure that. But this is still an area where we really need to improve our causality in our studies before we can say things for sure.
I mean, but how are you ever going to get to a causality conclusion, though, with all of these other factors like income, geography, socioeconomic status, the structure of the home, all sorts of things? I mean, I feel like that's one of the fundamental problems with parenting. But a conclusion that I draw from your book is that as you've said a couple of times already, if parents really parental value matters the most, maybe one of the things we ought to be doing is supporting parents more broadly, societally, like taking away income as a determinative factor by providing parents greater support who have lower incomes.
No, and I've said this a number of times in writing and elsewhere. I mean, I think that like a lot of our conversations about parenting revolve around questions where basically the answer is like, yeah, any kind of preschool is fine. Like the different preschool philosophies, there isn't much evidence that any of them matter. Once you're in the space of thinking about what's the right preschool philosophy, you know, your kid's going to do well. But at the same time, you know, particularly in the U.S., we have tremendous inequality in outcomes, tremendous inequality in resources, and thinking about using some of our energy to think about how can we improve policies to reach people who have fewer resources to equalize the opportunities for kids. I think that's just like incredibly important and is missed in these conversations a lot of the time.
Do we see those confounding factors in something as widely discussed as breastfeeding, for example?
We do. So I think breastfeeding is another example where actually, you know, breastfeeding rates were pretty low in the early 1970s. And then when they increased from the 1970s to today, which they have quite a lot, those increases have been much larger among white, more educated, higher income women than among other groups. And so what that means is when you look at evidence on the relationship between breastfeeding and an outcome like IQ, you find that, you know, kids who are breastfed have on average higher IQs than kids who are not, but they also have parents who are more educated, who themselves have higher IQ, have all kinds of other resources. And so it is very difficult to separate the effect of breastfeeding from the effect of those other things. And in many studies, it is likely that most or perhaps all of the effects of breastfeeding are in fact driven by these differences across moms and not by the breastfeeding itself.
So you know that there has been some pushback on your analysis about breastfeeding, right? Experts from the world of public health say that you're looking at data sets through an economist lens, but if you look at breastfeeding through the public health lens, that they still feel that it's very, very important to encourage mothers to breastfeed as much as possible.
Yeah. So I'll say sort of two things to that. So first, I think the book is pretty clear. I do think there are significant benefits to breastfeeding. So if you ask the question, is breast best? I think, yeah, basically it is best. There are some digestive benefits early in life. There are some maybe ear infection benefits early in life. There are some probably long-term benefits to the mom in terms of breast cancer reduction. So there are definitely benefits. I think where we disagree is in the impacts of breastfeeding on some things like IQ or obesity, longer-term effects for the kids, where I don't think the quality of the data supports those links. And so I think that's the sort of substantive nature of the disagreement. You know, in terms of what are we disagreeing about on the methods, I think it's pretty simple. I think in the way that I think about these data, I have tried to focus in on the studies that I think are actually showing us causal relationships. And I think sometimes in these analyses in epidemiology, there is a sense in which if you have 15 studies which say the same thing, that is taken as evidence in favor of some result. But in many cases, those 15 studies are all flawed in exactly the same way. And my approach is to say, you know what, I'm not going to really rely on any of those studies because they all have this terrible problem. Instead, I'm going to look at these three good studies which get around this problem, and I'm going to draw conclusions based on that. And I think that that's sort of the nature of some of the disagreement.
Well, so can you tell us a little bit more then about at least one of those studies that you felt showed some kind of causal relationship?
Yeah. So let's take something like... something where it's a positive, like a good effect of breastfeeding, or like, okay, so let me give you an example of a study that I think is good. This is a study that looks at the relationship between breastfeeding and IQ. And so what the authors in this study show is first, they compare kids who are breastfed to who are not without any other adjustments for differences across their families. And they find, you know, like a 7 or 8 point difference in IQ. They then adjust in their regressions using their methods for some demographics like education or income of the mom, and the effect drops to maybe 1.5 or 2 IQ points. So it drops, but it's still significant. It's still a meaningful size. They then control for more things about the mom, particularly for her IQ, and the effect drops even more. They then, in their last piece, they control for literally who the mom is by comparing siblings, mm-hmm. and they find that there's no effect. Like, it's literally zero. And so I think that's a nice kind of study because when we get to the end, we say, okay, now we're kind of doing as much as we can. We can say it's the difference between two kids with exactly the same mom, all the same other family characteristics. The only difference is that one is breastfed and one is not. And in addition, we can see why a study which, say, was only able to control for mom's education and income, why that would be biased. And many, many of the studies we have around this are in that category of they control for a few things, and they don't go, in my view, far enough to sort of fully controlling.
Okay. But are there enough studies that go far enough then to make any sort of concrete conclusions about breastfeeding?
So I think there are, so we have one pretty large randomized trial, which is kind of old and people have some problems with, but, you know, is a good study. And that's where, you know, we can see things like impacts on digestion, impacts on some early life rashes. So there are a few things that we see supported there, and then many things where the data in the randomized trial does not support a link. And we actually have a bunch of these, you know, sibling studies and things like that. Would it be better to have more data? Like, of course, we could always use more data. I mean, I love data. I would always like to have more of it, but I do think we have a fair amount of evidence that, you know, both confirms some of these links but refutes other ones.
Well, so just so that folks know, and Professor Oster, I'm sure you already know that the New Yorker, in its profile of you, its recent profile of you, quoted Dr. Lori Feldman Winter, the chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics section on breastfeeding, and Dr. Feldman Winter suggested that people take a look at the U.S. government's own recent survey review on breastfeeding, and she says that there's evidence there of long-term effects of breastfeeding, including a reduction in asthma and type 1 diabetes that you dismiss.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so an example is one of the things that she cites is the risk of a link with ulcerative colitis. And you can look at the quality of the evidence on that, and the evidence on that is based on studies where people in their 30s who have ulcerative colitis are asked about whether they were breastfed, and then they are compared to some other people selected in a different manner who do not have this disease, who are also asked about this. That introduces both the issues around recall. So it's not, we're not asking about people right now. It introduces, the sample sizes are very small. And in fact, many reviews of this will say, you know, those links are not, like, we don't really have much evidence in favor of those links. So I think on the one hand, like, collecting information about this is good. On the other hand, I think not all the data is super supportive. And I also think it's pretty important for us to think about the impacts of these messages. So in some sense, I think the message of policy has really been, or the idea behind these policies has been to tell women if you just to like tell women how important this is, under the assumption if people think this is important, they will just do it. So just we keep hitting on, you know, here are all the things, here are all the ways it's going to benefit for your kid. If your kid doesn't have breastfed, they're going to be, you know, do poorly in school and they'll be overweight and they'll be sick all the time. And like, that'll be your fault. And you better do this because otherwise it's going to be your fault when they're a failure. I think on the, and then of course, some people can't breastfeed. It doesn't work for them. You know, like physically, it doesn't work for them, or, you know, they try and their kid isn't getting enough nutrients. I mean, this happens. And the result is that people feel awful. They feel like basically they have failed. This is the first test as a parent and they have failed. And the number of emails I get from people that say, you know, breastfeeding didn't work for me. And I spent the first several months of my kid's life depressed and constantly feeling like I was a terrible parent. And I don't think that's the intention of these messages, but I think it is sometimes the result. And so I would like to see us send a message that says, yeah, breast is best. And it would be great if, you know, you could do it and has these benefits. And, you know, let's try to help you do that, with an emphasis on let's try to help you. Like, let's try to support moms who want to do this. Let's try to help them work through some of the early challenges because you might like it. It might work for you. Rather than saying, you know, I'm not going to give you any support. Don't take your breasts out in public. But by the way, if you don't do this thing, your kid's going to be a failure.
Yeah. I'm not, I think there are a lot of people out there, both, you know, in the healthcare field and in supporting new parents who, I'm not sure. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure how many people say breast is best, but we're not going to help you. Don't breastfeed it in public. Like that seems to be a little bit of an extreme take on how people are talking about this when they support breastfeeding.
Not the health stuff, but I think for society, right? So yeah. We tell people this is the most important thing, and then, you know, if you breastfeed in a Walmart, people are like, please take that into the bathroom. So, you know, I think that, yeah, maybe that's a little bit of an extreme take, but I do think that people end up feeling, for whatever reason, women for whom breastfeeding does not work often feel very, very bad. And I think that's probably not helpful for anybody.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that, because as you're saying, the messaging throughout pregnancy and then in early infancy is indeed, here are all the reasons why you should. And women aren't, I think many women aren't given adequate preparation about how hard it can be. And so that's another discussion for another time entirely. But let's get back to our callers. McGinley is calling from Lubeck, Maine. McGinley, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm currently 51, and when I was in high school, junior high actually, home economics was required both in 7th and 8th grade for boys and for girls. And in the state of Maine, maybe in the cities, but in rural Maine, it's been pretty much eliminated. About 15 years ago, budget cuts, they eliminated it. And I think that's really a devastating impact on families in figuring out how to make things work. And one example is I had two friends, they both worked at the paper mill, husband and wife, both worked at the paper mill, had three kids, all young, had them in daycare, and it cost a lot of money to keep the three kids in daycare. Well, she got laid off, and they were like, oh my God, how are we going to do this? So two of the kids had moved on to kindergarten and first grade, so she only had one left, and they went to a credit counselor, and they ran the numbers, and she found out after the fact that if they had shaved $50 from their budget, she could have home-raised her own kids and not have gone to work. Like, they were just $50 away a month from her having raised all three of her own kids instead of having two of them raised in daycare. And they were totally floored, and she was mortified. So, you know, the benefit being she was able to be there with her child, the third one.
Right.
But the first two, you know, and it's like people think they have to, they don't have the economic training. And that's what we got in home economics. You know, we were taught how to balance a checkbook, how to figure out how much food you could afford, your rent and all of that. And we're not doing that anymore. And it's like, they think people are magically going to figure it out or something, but we were taught that in school, and here somebody, it had a huge impact on their family when they realized it.
Yeah. Well, McGinley, thank you so much for your call there. We got to take a quick break here. So Emily Oster, when we come back, we will pick up this question about work and parenting, especially in the early years of a child's life. We're talking this hour with Professor Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, author of the new book, Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. What's your question for Emily Oster? Do you like the idea of looking to data to help solve your parenting challenges? Or because the question of parental value is so central to this discussion, are data going to help at all? This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Professor Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, author of the new book, Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. That just came out this spring. Her earlier book from 2013 was Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. Now, Professor Oster, before the break, we had that caller who had the anecdote about a friend who, there were two working parents. She was just suggesting that if they had better personal finance or home economics education when they were younger, they might have been able to understand their financial situation better, and that might have changed some choices around whether or not a parent should stay at home. This was in the wake of one of them losing their jobs. Now, I'm not going to get into a conversation about whether we need more home ec or personal finance.
That's a different show.
I think everyone needs more personal finance education. But let's talk about this question of, because you write about it in the book, about the question of working parents versus stay-at-home parents. So what do the data say?
So when I sort of structured that chapter, I think the question a lot of people have is, you know, is it better for my kid to have a stay-at-home or a working parent? And I look into the data there. I mean, this data has a lot of the same problems as a lot of what we've talked about. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of parents where one parent stays home and one doesn't, that's a different family on average with different features. And so it's a little tricky. And we actually do have some, you know, reasonable data there, at least about staying home kind of in the first couple of years, actually comes from sort of policy changes. But when we look at that data overall, when I sort of think about it holistically, I think the data does not suggest that either of these approaches is better for your kid. So the outcomes for kids, you know, the ones we can measure, things like test scores and behavior, they look pretty much the same, regardless of whether both parents choose to work or one parent chooses to stay home. And I think in a sense that kind of frees up this discussion to focus a little bit more on other considerations in the family, one of which is budgeting. So I actually talk a little bit about, you know, how to think about the short and long run impacts of you know, having two people work versus you know, paying for childcare versus having someone stay home. And I think actually being realistic about those discussions is pretty important.
Yeah.
And the other thing I talk about is, you know, thinking about what the parents want. So, you know, do you want to work? And I think that's often really missing from these discussions, but I think is actually quite an important part of the decision. And once you put aside, you say, you know, my kid can be a happy, like productive kid with either of these choices, you then narrow in on what works for the family.
Yeah. So how did that apply in your life after your children were born?
So I, you know, I like my job a lot. And, you know, I say in the book, you know, I'm in a very lucky situation where like I could afford not to work. You know, we could we could, my husband has a job and we could rearrange our lives so I could stay home with my kids. But I don't think that would work for us. I really like my job. I really like my kids. I like them in some ways more than my job. But I talk a little bit in the book about the idea that the, as I say, marginal value of my time with my kids decays because, you know, you get tired and the fourth hour playing trains is, you know, maybe kind of tiring. Whereas the fourth hour at my job isn't as draining. And so, although I like my kids better in some aggregate sense than I like my job, I think for me, the right thing to do is to have a job. And so I in some sense, I think you should be able to say, you know, I have a job because I like it. I like my job.
You know, I have to say, I appreciate you bringing this language of the marginal enjoyment of time with your children, because I think that's one of the things that people, especially, I'm going to say, especially women, need help with today. And that is just being given space to actually talk about these things without being judged, right? Because I imagine that there are a lot of women out there who want to say the same things, that say, I love my kids. As you said, in aggregate, I love them more than anything else. But at the same time, I have these other needs and interests in my life that factor into the well-being of our whole family. But you can't even say that because you feel guilty about it, or people are going to judge you about it.
No, and certainly people, I mean, this, you know, I've said this in the book and I've said it elsewhere. And definitely there are people who are like, you know, why would you even have kids if you didn't want to spend every minute with them? And, you know, that this is like, you know, a signal of someone who should never have had kids. And of course, I don't think that. But I do think it's illustrative of, you know, it's hard to say these things because we do have this culture around the idea that, you know, being the perfect mom means, you know, being 100% engaged with everything your kid is doing all of the time and not really thinking about yourself. And I think that's, you know, that I don't think that's really necessary to be a good parent.
Yeah. And I just want to note that, you know, especially in the early months of a child's life, many parents do not have a choice. Like, they need that dual income, and parents have to go back to work whether they want it or not. I mean, that is a big
yes.
challenge for millions of parents in America. I want to just acknowledge that.
And, I think we should say that, like, there's actually quite good evidence that maternity leave early on is very good for babies and families. And so, you know, as we sort of think about policy solutions, I think that's an important one.
Yeah, maternity leave, paternity leave, yeah, or family leave in
family
general.
Leave.
And then also there's the long-term consideration, because I was interested to hear you say that you talk about the short and long-term financial considerations about work. And for women, well, there seems to be pretty ample evidence that if they spend a considerable amount of time out of the labor market raising children, that it kind of puts them permanently behind in terms of future wages.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even if you don't spend a considerable amount of time out of the labor market, but I certainly think part of the discussion is to think about not just, you know, what are the kind of family budget consequences in the first year, but what are they going to be in 6 years or 10 years when the kind of cost of childcare has gone down a lot? And, you know, you would be making considerably more if you had stayed in the labor force. So I think that is a part of the consideration.
Let's go back to the phones. Adriana is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I'm actually calling in to say how refreshing it is to have the interviewee's perspective, because I was, as a mother, I had postpartum depression and anxiety very early on and did not take medication because I wanted to be successful at breastfeeding and didn't want the cross-contamination. So I just think that it's really difficult to have these overarching absolutes in parenthood. And it's very nice to hear your guest's perspective on staying at home or working or breastfeeding or not. It's kind of more a case-by-case basis. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Well, Adriana, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Kate, who's calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling because I come from a situation where there were six kids in the family. I'm now 68 years old, so my mother passed away a while ago. But my parents were both attorneys, and they were also good Catholics. And unfortunately, my mother had a very good job that she was amazed to get back in the 50s, because they didn't hire women very much. Anyway, she got pregnant and proceeded to have six children, because, as I said, she was a good Catholic, and never got to work again, except peripherally. League of Women Voters and such.
Mm-hmm.
situations. And I think now it's just so, it's really wonderful that that women have more choices and that they can try and make things work out that, you know, 50 years ago just weren't on the table for them.
Yeah.
So it's a very difficult question, situation to work out, but it's worth all our efforts to do so.
Kate, thank you for your call. Emily Oster, did you want to say something to that?
No, I mean, I think I think I would just point out that it's we often get wrapped up in these choices as sort of like, oh, it's so difficult because now we have all these different things we could choose. But I think that that, you know, that is a very good reminder that that we are awfully lucky to get to have those choices, which earlier generations and people elsewhere and many people in the world don't necessarily have.
So I wanted to ask you about whether you looked at issues in parenting or data sets that that were particular to dads, because the center of gravity of these conversations sometimes automatically tends towards moms. But were there dad specific things that you took a look at?
You know, I think a lot of these decisions in parenting are pretty joint. Mm-hmm. So when we think about things like sleep, you know, those are decisions which kind of both parents make together. And I try pretty hard in the book to kind of separate out or be kind of agnostic about, even we think about working. Yeah, it's true. We often talk about, you know, stay at home versus working mom. But you know, there's no particular reason that that has to be the parent who stays home. And I think that's an important kind of conversation to have. I will say I don't have a lot of very specific dad stuff in the book outside of some discussion of marital satisfaction.
Now, was there anything in the process of researching this book that you wish you had known when your children were very young?
So, I mean, I think the one thing where the evidence changed between my two kids is about peanuts. About allergen introduction. So when my daughter was born, I was told, you know, don't give her any peanuts until she's a year. And between my two kids, we got much, much better evidence, which suggested that that is exactly the wrong advice, that you should be giving your kids peanuts, not specifically peanuts, but peanut butter or peanut powder when they're very young, like as early as 4 or 5 months, because that actually prevents allergies from developing. Luckily for me, my daughter does not have an allergy, but that's certainly something where had I known that fact with the first kid, I definitely would have done things differently, and I did do them differently with my second kid.
In fact, I mean, I think even the American Academy of Pediatrics is changing its recommendations
on
early peanut exposure. That's right.
Absolutely.
Well, so and what about discipline? That was one thing that really fascinated me because it's such a touchy subject. What'd you learn about the data around discipline techniques?
So I look at data around sort of, are there any discipline techniques which work? which I think we all wonder about all the time. I actually found there is pretty good evidence in favor of these positive parenting techniques, which include, for example, something like 1-2-3 Magic or The Incredible Years. There's a bunch of different versions. And they all sort of emphasize the idea of, you know, when you want to stop bad behaviors, of engaging in a consistent, you know, warning system of warnings and consequences, where the consequence is, you know, a timeout or a loss of a privilege. And that kids respond really well to the idea that, okay, here is the consistent set of things you're going to get. You get a warning, get a second warning, then you get a timeout. And if you follow through on that, you can get very good results. And the evidence suggests, even from some randomized trials, that actually this can improve kids' behavior and their relationships with their parents.
Did your findings surprise you about discipline?
Yeah, they did actually. So I only looked into this for the book because my editor was like, come on, please do this. Look at this, you know, and I was like, fine. And I was like, oh, there's not going to be anything. And then actually there was good evidence, which I found pretty surprising. And it's actually one of the few places where the book kind of led my parenting. So most of the things I did the research in service of the parenting and then, you know, then it ended up in the book. This was something where I did the research and I was like, okay, we have to change what we're doing. we got to get this on.
And did you find pretty quick results?
Yeah, it was great. Actually, it worked awesome. So this 1-2-3 Magic was in fact somewhat magical.
Well, so it's interesting that was one of the few places where you, you know, in after doing all this research that you changed, you know, your approach to parenting with your own kids. Because this leads me back to a little bit about where we started. I'm wondering if in this day and age, we are so data obsessed. And I know I'm asking an economist this. I just want to say that. I get that. But we are so data obsessed. You know, people are walking around wearing those Fitbits. We're looking for evidence bases for every decision that we need to make. But that parenting will always be one of those things that, to your point earlier, data might help us make us feel better, but it's really not going to lead us to help us make the best decisions for us and our families.
Yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately, you know, it is impossible to always feel you have made the right choice. Parenting is about, you know, having all of these moments where you're like, oh, I wish I had done that differently, or maybe I should have done that differently. And, you know, it kind of doesn't matter how much evidence you have or data, you are always going to spend some of your time feeling like you're sort of floundering through some kind of jello puddle trying to grasp at things. And yeah, so I think that, you know, I think there are limits. I think, you know, there is value in this approach, but it isn't going to tell you like how to be the optimal. It's not going to optimize your parenting in all dimensions.
I mean, that is literally the story of every day of my life, wondering like, oh, that thing that just happened this morning, I wish I didn't. Like,
wish I didn't. Wish I did that different. That maybe it's okay, or yes.
I didn't see any data on how to handle parental guilt.
Right. Yes. Unfortunately, we have none of that.
and also,
just try not to think about it.
And also, so here's the thing, because ultimately we're talking about relationships between human beings, right? Between members of families, between parents and their children. And those relationships are different even from children to children. I mean, I've found that certain things that work with my older one won't work at all with my younger one. So that leaves me also at sea in terms of trying to relearn or continue to develop techniques, relationships, just a way of being with each individual child.
Yeah, I think this problem only gets more difficult as your kids get older and they get more, you know, more different from each other. You know, like a lot of babies, you know, I mean, they may be different inside, but they seem pretty similar. But as your kids develop more personality and more, you know, you start to see the things that they're going to struggle with and the things you have to do differently with them. And it's both harder in some ways and also more daunting because you're like, okay, now I can like really mess them up because I really got to do this right, but I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple seconds that we have, is there an area of modern parenting that you really want more data on?
I think the place I look like all parents is for more evidence on screen time. You know, I go through a little bit of this in the book, but I think the truth is our evidence on, you know, how much iPad time is okay. Is it okay for them to have a phone? What's the age to have a phone? You know, should my 2-year-old see this? This is something where our evidence is just very poor, but it's clearly something we all think about a lot.
Well, Emily Oster is a professor of economics at Brown University and author of the new book, Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. Professor Oster, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Magda.
Omaha Guy, by the way, on our website says the deck is stacked against parents in general. The only honest advice is to make sure that people have a fair shot at life. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.